Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where on the planet you are. Again, this is Eric Rubenstein, and I am Advise Health's Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support. And this is another episode in the continuing podcast I've been doing called Retro Fraud, where I'm talking to people that I worked with in my career and people tangentially within the healthcare fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance space to talk about cases that were worked historically over the years and how those cases really morph into today's fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance issues. Today's episode, I've got a great friend, both professionally and personally, Joe Mack. Joe Mack was an assistant U.S. attorney in the District of New Jersey. I'm actually wearing a shirt that he gave me. It's a double or a triple extra large, so I'm often wondering if he actually gave me the shirt as an intended gift, if he thinks that my head wouldn't fit into a medium, which is what I really think I am, or if this was a shirt that was destined for someone else but came in at the wrong size, and instead of throwing it away, he gave it to me. But either way, I appreciate the gift, and I wear it with pride. I worked with Joe for a long time on cases in the District of New Jersey where he was an assistant U.S. attorney at one point in the healthcare fraud unit. I left when I retired in January of 2019. Joe had left just a little bit before that, and he went on to work in the regulatory space. So, Joe, if you could just give everybody a little bit of a history of your tenure at the U.S. attorney's office and such, greatly appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Eric, and welcome, everybody. Glad to be on this. I think Eric covered our working relationship pretty well. We probably worked together for 7 of the nearly 10 years that I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office. When I started in the U.S. Attorney's Office, like a lot of prosecutors, I was in sort of a generalized unit, the violent crime unit. So I did gun crimes, I did bank robberies. But then very quickly, I started doing healthcare fraud cases, specialized in those, as well as tax cases. And I don't want anybody to think that I was the only one that provided apparel. Eric also provided me with some apparel while I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office. This actually fits perfectly, so I think Eric probably did buy it for me. But I don't want to appear too jovial, so I'll take it off. I just want people to, you know, fully appreciate that. So I was in the healthcare and government fraud unit for the last basically, 8 or 9 years of my career, and helped supervise that unit for the last 4.
Yeah, that's great. So Joe left and he works now in the regulatory space. He left the U.S. Attorney's Office and took his healthcare knowledge and moved on like a lot of people do. Obviously, people that work in healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse from the criminal perspective, as well as the civil perspective, take that experience and education that they get working cases. I would always say that under my tutelage, Joe became a successful criminal prosecutor and was able to move on. And even today, Joe and I sit on panels together in the compliance and regulatory space, either as co-panelists or more often lately, Joe has been moderating panels that I've been on with respect to fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance, primarily in the pharmaceutical industry, where I do some regulatory and compliance work. Today, I'm really excited to talk to Joe about a case that we worked together that went on for a number of years, where I was reminded by Joe a few minutes before we started that we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of the initiation of the investigation. And it involves an MRI radiological facility by the name of Orange Community MRI, which happened to be in Orange, New Jersey, central New Jersey, just outside of Newark. And that case came through me. I was working a criminal investigation involving an entirely unrelated matter. And during the course of that investigation, we learned some information about Orange Community MRI. And just from a very quick background, the case originally started with an internal medicine doctor who was billing for a number of services that were fraudulent in nature, the least of which was physical therapy services and something called ECP or EECP, enhanced external counterpulsation. He was operating clinics in 5 or 6 different locations at the same time. Those services all required that he be present or that they be incident to his services. None of those services were being rendered under appropriate guidance from CMS, the least of which was that he had all unlicensed people working for him rendering physical therapy in all of his offices. Therefore, none of those services were actually physical therapy and actually had the potential of causing some harm because he was doing something called ultrasound, which is a heat-generated service. This individual doctor, when approached regarding the fraud involving the physical therapy in the ECP, agreed to something called a proffer, came in with a lawyer. Proffer is that legal term. Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the definition is an offering or an opportunity for the person to come in. The sort of standard phrase that people will use is queen for a day. You come in and you essentially get to spill your guts regarding frauds that you are aware of, that you're involved with the prospect that the statements that you make can't be used against you directly. We're not going to get into the legal discussions about the collateral uses of those statements and how evidence can be used to be developed based upon those statements, but the statements themselves can't be used. But people will come in when they're looking to cooperate on an investigation, either for their own culpability or regarding their own culpability and culpability of others in other matters. And during that interview, Joe, if you remember, the first day we interviewed this provider on two consecutive days. And on the first day, I'll never forget, we were sitting in a very small conference room on the fifth floor at the federal building in the U.S. Attorney's Office. It was a room with no windows. It was your typical interview room, a table, a lot of books that no one had looked at in probably 20 years. And in the course of proffering this internal medicine doctor, he indicated that just a day or two before, he had been given a sum of cash in return for referring patients to Orange Community MRI and asked if we would be interested in that. And of course, we said yes. He came back the next day for part two of his proffer and pulled out of his briefcase. If you remember, he pulled out two bundles of cash, $5,000 bundles of cash in small bills for 10 grand. And then we were sort of off to the races.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing that it was 10 years ago. I remember it very, very clearly. And it was an exciting thing because I think at the start, we didn't really know what we were getting into. We're like, and the queen for a day, just for the benefit of the folks that are listening, you know that you're in trouble to begin with. You're not getting any type of immunity. But like Eric said, you can't use your statements against you. But if you're coming in to proffer to the government, you and your defense counsel have already agreed, like, okay, we got to see if we can cooperate. We got to see if we can get a better deal for you. And by the way, maybe there's something you can cooperate on to help eventually get some leniency in sentencing. But it was a fast and furious 2 months. I mean, it was a lot of work, especially really, I'll let Eric talk to it. I mean, it was really a lot of work on the agent's end. I mean, I helped develop our strategy. We talked about how the conversations were going to go, but Eric and the agents that worked with you had to make sure that we had, the equipment set up. And what we did was basically, they took a dress shirt, much like this, and they replaced this button and turned it into a video camera. They replaced it with a video camera. And that was how conversations were taped between this cooperator and the various HCPs that were taking those kickback monies. And I think before you even get to the point, though, of someone cooperating in something like that, from an agent's perspective, Eric, I mean, you had to get the cooperator to a point where he wanted to do that. This is one thing to come in and cooperate and tell people, like, this is what I know. But what we needed for this case to be successful is we needed proactive cooperation. And that means the cooperator going out, taping people, taping, frankly, friends, acquaintances he had met, people he was friendly with, and having those conversations with them. So I think there's probably a lot of background work on your part to even get that person comfortable.
Yeah. So the thing about this case that is interesting, and people should feel free to go online to their favorite search engine and type in Orange Community MRI prosecutions. There were a total of about 20. We'll talk briefly about those at the end. But, it all starts with the initial person that's cooperating. So this was an internal medicine doctor who was the recipient of kickbacks. And he was able to provide us with the names of a couple of people that he had dealt with from the MRI center, one of which was a sales rep who was his point of contact. And the other one was sort of the director of operations for the MRI center. Interestingly enough, what we learned very quickly in this case was it was a very culturally centric case. Although our provider was of Mexican descent, the owner of the MRI center and all of the doctors, with the exception of I think one or two, were all of Indian descent from the same state in India. And so it was a very culturally centered case, because which makes those kind of cases very difficult. As people have heard on other podcasts I've done, when you're talking about culturally centric related investigations, it's very hard to pierce the envelope to get into some of those communities because of the inherent lack of trust outside of the cultural community. The way that we looked to approach this case and sort of worked with Joe on this, because Joe had come from working gangs and drug-related cases, was to work our way up the chain. And to do that, we sort of looked at this from the perspective of, you don't go after the low-level drug dealers, you go after the kingpin. And so our main cooperator, who was the our initial cooperator, who was the internal medicine doctor, agreed to do recordings and all of that. And you know, ultimately what he was able to do was he was able to get the original sales rep that had paid him the $10,000 into a meeting where he talked about how unhappy he was about the amount of money that he was being paid. He really wasn't unhappy, but that was the line that he gave. And we were able to capture those conversations on audio and video, which led us to another sales rep who was the individual who was giving the money to the internal medicine doctor sales rep. So we went up a couple of layers, and it's a very long convoluted tale, but ultimately our main cooperator was here in the country on what's known as an H-1B visa, which was an employment visa. And his employer was actually the director of operations for Orange Community MRI, who also owned an IT services company. And so our cooperator was working at Orange Community MRI really as an IT professional, and didn't want to say no to his employer and his childhood friend, who was also his visa holder. So it was a very, very difficult situation, but he ultimately was going around paying the kickbacks. It was anywhere between $40,000 and $50,000 a month. The owner of the MRI facility would bring cash to our cooperator on a monthly basis. And our cooperator would then go and do calculations based upon the number of referrals that each provider made each month for MRIs, CTs, X-rays, and the like. And they had a sliding scale. If it was a Medicare or Medicaid patient, it was one fee. It was commercial, it was another fee. And we were off to the races. We went out and pretty much on a nearly daily basis, at the least three or four times a week, we were going out with our cooperator while he was going out making these cash payments. One thing that Joe sort of alluded to was our cooperator was wearing some covert recording equipment, audio and video. Joe, as the prosecutor, has to make an assessment at the end of each day's recordings. We're going back, we're downloading the recordings, we're looking at them, and Joe has to make an assessment about whether or not that recording is substantial evidence or not to prove that allegation. Some providers would just take the money and there would be no conversation. Others would take the money, have conversation, but not open the envelope and look at the money. So, Joe, talk a little bit about, you know, as you're looking at these recordings, and as you're going through, you know, what is making you say, hey, we need two recordings for each provider, we need three recordings? Like, what's your thought process on that?
Yeah, I have to tell you, it was funny to me, because I thought when we had the first recording that it was just going to be like, okay, we got a great recording, we have it, and we're done. But what had happened was, because our cooperator had been going to these HCPs for months, years in many cases, there was just a standard operating procedure, and he would just walk in and just hand the envelope and they stuff it in their jacket and they're done. And that wasn't going to get it done, because what's important, I think, is you need to be able to explain to a jury eventually, if you need to, which we did. You need to be able to explain to them what's going on here. So, you know, you need to have a conversation. You need to have, like, hey, this is for October's referrals. And part of what you know, was maybe difficult is they weren't usually having those conversations. It was just sort of just right. like, hey, it's like, you know, here comes the, right. you know, here comes your grocery store dropping off your groceries and you
here
just
comes
go
Mr.
about your day.
Here comes yeah, Mr. Right. Green. You know, I mean, yeah. I remember one of the doctors that was prosecuted, and obviously this is all public record talking about, if you remember, one of the docs that was prosecuted, not only was he doing the work that he was doing with internal medicine, but he was also like an anti-aging doctor. And, you know, he was treating one of the ladies that was on Housewives of New Jersey. And yeah. they had filmed just the day before in his office. And our cooperator went the day after the filming, and our target doc was talking about how they had just been there, and you know, Housewives of New Jersey. And the thing that really got me about that particular doctor was his referral pattern was only about $150 or $200 a month, and if you remember in the first recording. He shakes our cooperator's hand when he's walking out and he says, my allegiance is to you. And I just remember that, you know, I couldn't believe how egregious it was that this was a guy who just sold his soul for $200, which I remember joking to other people on the case that, you know, he drove a big SUV and that $200 a month was probably not even gas money for the month. And he just sold his soul for really what amounted to $150 or $200. So, you know, there was no limit.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was some level of convenience, right? Because they didn't have to, you know, the money got delivered to them. And I think that, you know, it was fairly discreet. You know, it comes in a white envelope. There was, and this was part of our trial proceedings, you know, there was some math involved, which always troubled me. There was a reason I never became, I never finished my schooling as an accountant. I couldn't pass the CPA exam because the math escaped me. So I had to go to law school. But, you know, there were certain rates for Medicare, there were certain rates for Medicaid, and then there were certain rates for private insurance companies. And we would work with our cooperator and we just said to him, okay, do the calculation as you normally would. And he would break out, okay, there were this many Medicare, this many Medicaid, this many private insurance, put the money together. And that was what was delivered. And that was what was taped. And that became some of the most crucial evidence, right? Because, you know, because then you start doing fuse context into these videos. And
right.
you know, to go back to your earlier question, I don't know. Yes, here, and this is a little bit difficult to read, but it's a screenshot of a video, and these were some of the calculations that our cooperator had done prior to right. Eric's approach to him. So this was some right. of the evidence originally captured, right?
Yeah. So each month, our cooperating witness would sit down on like the first of the month, and when the referrals came in. The front desk people would keep a spreadsheet of the doctor that made the referral, the test, the patient, all this demographic information. And truthfully, the people at the front desk weren't doing it for any nefarious purpose. They were really doing it as a tracking tool so that if a patient, if a doctor didn't have a particular report and they wanted a report, all the front desk people needed was the patient's name, you know, and around the time they came in, and they would just be able to easily find it. But what wound up happening is our cooperator was using it for the nefarious purpose of being able to filter and sort and come up with these calculations. And this is not a great screenshot because this is actually from a video that was taken from one of the videos of our cooperator wearing a covert camera. And what's happening is in the video, the doctor that was paid the kickbacks is arguing with our cooperator over the amount of money. And so our cooperator would show up, and just going back to the cultural piece is that prior to the individual cooperating, the provider, he would go to the provider's office and they wouldn't talk about the money. He would just hand them the envelope and then it would go away. But obviously we needed to have some conversation. So one of the things that Joe and I had come up with as a tactic was to start shortchanging the providers by $5 or $10.
Because we needed to generate conversation around it, right?
Right.
I mean, it was just yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So we would say to the cooperator, like, look, we know you're supposed to give them $230, put $210 in the, or $220, because you have $20 bills, put $220 in the envelope, tell the provider you're sorry you didn't have change, the register was broken, you didn't have your hot dog change maker or whatever, and you'll get them the next time. And so he would do that. And it was amazing to me how many providers over $5 or $10 would say, okay, you know, make sure you get me next time. Like, they didn't want to like let it go. But what he would do is he would sit down on the first of every month, take that spreadsheet from the previous month, and do all the math for each provider, how many MRIs, how many CTs, and he would do it on the sheet. So this is not a great screenshot because it's part of a live video that was taken, but it just shows you that, you know, he had these calculations and he can go and he can do this. And he would do this each month. And then we would sit down with him and go over those calculations so that we understood his spreadsheet and that we would, you know, we'd be able to understand, you know, what was going on. And then what would happen is during the course of the meeting, you know, while this meeting was going on, our guy would go in and here's a screenshot. Again, the quality is not great because this is a moving video, but you know, what you could see is here's on the right side is the hand, is our cooperator's hand. He had just gone into his pocket. He pulled out two envelopes. They have the initials of our provider and he's handing the envelopes to our provider, who's then taking the money. Finally, to show everybody sort of that full circle is that once that happened, here's our provider. This is one of the trial defendants. His name is Casey Onienzo. He went to trial, was convicted in about an hour. What you can sort of see in the bottom right-hand corner, and again, in the video, you see it much more clearly, is the two envelopes are going into his pocket. He's stuffing them in his pocket. And those are obviously pieces of compelling evidence. So I guess, like, in the interest of time, Joe, let's move on. So we have 20 defendants. Ultimately, we have recordings, two recordings with some. In some cases, the recordings aren't spectacular, so we have to go back and do a third recording. And by spectacular, meaning that in some cases, the provider just doesn't want to engage. They're too busy. They're seeing patients. They take the envelope. They shoo our guy away. And so in some of the instances where we're doing a third payment, we don't even put the money in an envelope. We just give the cash to the provider and say, this is your payment for last month's referrals. And we get the provider to acknowledge that and then, you know, just sort of go on. And so let's talk a little bit about some of your thought process in like, okay, this is great. We only need one recording. We want to make sure we have consistency with two. You know, what's your thought process in making some of these assessments?
So I think that we decided we really needed, we wanted two recordings for each defendant, because obviously you don't want a situation where they just, oh, well, that was a one-time thing and it couldn't happen. You don't want that to be really any type of defense. So if you have two occasions, I think that made it much stronger. We also wanted there to be some conversation about the money, the referral, some connection to patients, some outward indication that what was in the envelope wasn't like, you know, Bon Jovi concert tickets. It was actually cash, you know, because I think, you know, you would think that cases are really easy once you have them on video, but you need someone to narrate the video. And that was really the role of our cooperator at trial. But you also need the jury to see with their own eyes, okay, this is what I'm actually watching here. I just saw the cooperators say, here's the payment for last month's patients. So you're hearing payment, you're hearing patients, you're seeing the envelopes being taken, you're seeing the doctor keep the money. And juries need to, I think in today's environment, when you have, I mean, technology is just everywhere, juries expect that level of proof in some cases. I mean, I remember early on in my career, you know, I prosecuted gun and drug cases, and juries would want to know, where's the Where's the video of the defendant with a gun? Where are the fingerprints from the gun? I mean, this is the type of, they call it the CSI effect. So I think having videos that could stand alone, and obviously they didn't stand alone, but watching a juror, they're taking in the video, they can see what's going on and decide for themselves, okay, I know what this is. I'm using right. my common sense. So I think that
now,
was sort
of- a lot of times I say that in kickback cases, it obviously requires somebody to tell on themselves, right? Because in the absence of having, in the absence of having someone to be able to put color on the story, you have to be able to explain to a jury why something is a kickback in the absence of someone who's in, who's in, you know, involved in it. But, you know, obviously with a situation like this, where we're directing the cooperator to do certain things or say certain things, you know, like for example, don't put the cash in the envelope or say this. What would you say to those who are thinking about this or watching this, or the critics of the government, obviously, who are saying that, well, that's entrapment. The person, you made the person acknowledge something or something along those lines.
What you need to establish was on the day when you made, Eric, when you made the first approach of our cooperator, there were envelopes. There were those sheets that we just saw in that video still. That showed who these people were, who these doctors were. You show a course of dealing. So it's not entrapment if this is something that's been going on for a while. And you also, you know, entrapment is a technical defense. It is pretty hard to make out. And in a case like this, where you have, you know, the conversation going on, and look, in the course of normal human dealing, if someone handed you an envelope and you were expecting it to be Bon Jovi concert tickets, and instead it's $200 cash, if they said, hey, here's your $200 cash, say, well, wait a second, Eric, I thought these were Bon Jovi tickets. I thought you and I were hopping on the stage with Richie Sambora tonight. Then they say, wait a second, stop the presses. You're not handing me money. I want those tickets. So, you know, I think that people need to, like you said, I think see with their own eyes what's going on. You know, entrapment was not raised by any of the defendants at trial, on appeal. Obviously, we had 15 of the defendants that pled guilty, so they didn't raise those defenses either. So I don't really think that was much of a issue here in this case.
So we had a total of 20 people that we identified as targets. Our cooperator was making cash payments to 20, and just to sort of cut to the chase, three of them had been very early receivers of the kickbacks, meaning that we approached our main cooperator in the fall of 2011, and he had either not made any payments to three of the providers, had just entered into the agreements with them, or had made only one payment to the provider. So they were very early on. So you as the AUSA, who's sort of making some of the decisions in conjunction with the management at the U.S. Attorney's Office, declines those three people. I continued to pursue them under the civil monetary penalties laws, a CMP case through the OIG, because I felt like as a criminal investigator, as an OIG agent, my job was to ferret out the fraud, waste, and abuse. If the criminal division declined the case, I would bring it to the civil division. If the civil division was declining the case, I would bring it to OSIG. I always treated OSIG as like Mikey from Life Cereal. Like, you know, give it to Mikey, they'll eat it. And so there were three cases that were adjudicated through the CMP laws and were dealt with administratively, entered into civil settlement agreements. That left 17 defendants that were arrested. The thing that people, I think, don't fully understand is the amount of effort that goes into that. We conducted search warrants at a number of locations in conjunction with the arrest of 17 people, almost all at once. We arrested one a day or two before, who was the director, who was our main cooperator's boss, the IT guy, who was also the director. He cooperated. We had a couple of other recordings that went on, but ultimately it culminated with 14 or 15 simultaneous arrests and search warrants. It was a very big undertaking. And at the time, although I had some help with getting some of that work done, obviously from an investigative perspective, it takes a village I had at any given time, three or four agents would be out with me because we're making payments and my guy is driving around with $40,000-$50,000 in cash. I'll never forget when he pulled over in the middle of a very, very bad neighborhood, driving from one doctor's office to the other. He just pulls over in this terrible neighborhood in New Jersey. And we're like, oh my God, like this, why is he stopping the car? And we have, there's a bunch of agents, we're in two cars and we get out and he's in the front seat of the car with $50,000 in his lap. And he's counting out the money for the next stop. We had thought he had done it. We had talked to him about doing it. He said he had done it and he had done it. He had done it for everybody other than this one particular doctor. And it was a known drug area. And we're like, my God, this guy's going to get us all. We're all going to get killed over a $400 kickback payment. But so ultimately, we do 17 people get charged. And of those 17, 15 plead guilty. Actually, I should go back and say 16 were initially charged. The owner of the MRI facility, Dr. Ashok Babaria, wasn't even arrested and wasn't even charged. And after everybody was charged and the search warrants, his lawyers called you up and said, you know, can my guy come in and take a plea? And he hadn't even been charged yet, which was amazing. But we ultimately had 15 pleas and had two trials that occurred. I really call it two and two A, because we had one trial in which we had a hung jury, even though we had video. And then we had to retry it. So in the remaining little bit we have, I wanted to talk about like your experiences with those trials and sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly of having three trials that were supposed to last a week. Each one lasted 6 to 8 weeks. Three to four weeks,
I think. It might have felt like
we had the weather. We had weather breaks and holidays and stuff. So by the time we're done, it was like 6 weeks. And we've got trials that should have only been a week or so. Three trials over 14 months. I tell people all the time that 14-month period, if we weren't on trial, we were preparing for trial. So I want to talk a little bit in a little bit of time we have left about sort of what you thought about that and the lessons learned and the whole process.
Yeah, I mean, it was really intense because you had to put everything together. And we went the first time, we put the story in what we thought was the most logical fashion. So we lined up, sort of our government witnesses that will sort of explain the purpose of Medicare, witnesses that would explain that these payments were actually, that claims were actually submitted to Medicare for payment. We had some agent witnesses, and then we're gonna do the video at the end. The problem is that there were a lot of delays in the trial. It was the first trial was shortly after Hurricane Sandy, and there were some delays in trial. And by prolonging the ability for the jury to see, or rather delaying the jury's ability to see the video, it gave the defense a chance to sort of pick holes, different things, and sort of make different suggestions about what you're going to see in the video. I also think, you know, probably at the end of the day, it was probably not a great idea. You know, there was probably some issues in jury selection we might have done differently. But that being said, when we came around the second time, we said, you know what? We're going to go up there. We're going to give an opening statement, and we're going to tell the jury, you're going to see this video. You're going to see the defendant taking these payments. Let's show them that video right from Jump Street. So we sat down within that first hour in the second trial, they saw that video. And then what happens then is the video now defines everything that happens after it, which might not be the most logical way, but it was the most effective narrative. And I think, you know, the jury deliberation on the second trial was, you know, less than a day, and on a third trial was quite short. So I think that helped shape the narrative. When you're getting ready for trial, you have to think about what witnesses do you want to use? What order do you want to put them in? Frankly, one of the things that we had to figure out was whether or not we wanted Eric to testify for us. And we decided we didn't need Eric to testify for us. But the defense in the second trial decided that they wanted to call Eric to testify. And I always had such a great time in the courtroom, but there are few things that were more fun than cross-examining Eric, because those of you that are familiar with how criminal procedure works, on cross-examination, you can use leading questions. And I would just go up there and softball after softball, and Eric is cranking them out of the park. And the defense attorney realized it was, I think he realized that it was not a great decision to call Eric on his direct case.
So I think so, just so people get it, like, you know, when the government is putting on its case, they need to have a summary witness that'll go up and explain sort of the facts, right? So people that are, there's fact witnesses and then there are expert witnesses where experts can come in. They could actually speak off the cuff, provide their experience and say, well, I think that this is the way it is because I've done this for 25 years. Like, you know, what I've been fortunate enough in my role here at Advise is I've been retained as an expert in two different matters. And the interesting thing is that I get to say, this is the way it is. And my reason is because I've done this for 25 years and that's what the standard is. And that's actually what holds weight. And as a fact witness, you're just getting up, providing your summary, you're giving your statements. And, you know, typically an agent would get up and be that fact witness, the summary, sort of just outline an overview or summary of the case. And so we had a different agent get involved with helping with that. And in this one particular trial, the defense chose to make me one of their witnesses. And it was really, I remember sitting at the table with the paralegal at the time, and you're in sidebar, which is, you know, you're on the side talking to the judge, and it's you and the other prosecutor and the defense attorney. And while this conversation's going on, and I, you know, I can't hear it, the jury can't hear it. And at one point I look over and I see you and the other prosecutor are looking over at me and you're like half smiling. And I lean in to the paralegal and I said, oh my God, the defense attorney is going to call me. And the paralegal says, how do you know? And I went, well, look at these guys. You know, I said, you know, you and the other AUSA said, you keep looking over and smiling at me. It has to, there's no other way. And when you walked back, and as you're walking back, the defense attorney calls me to the stand. And, you know, I'm on the witness stand. And the one thing I remember very vividly was about 10 or 15 minutes in, when he was getting really aggressive and really loud, I remember you standing up and objecting, and the judge asked you what your objection was. And you said, well, it's not actually an objection, Your Honor, but the shouting, because the defense attorney had gotten just so aggressive with the pointing and the glasses on and off and the pointing and, you know, whatever it was. And it was an interesting time for me. I had testified as a fact witness on behalf of the prosecution a number of times in trials. I had, you know, look back, I had 8 or 9 criminal trials, and I've had a civil false claims trial. I had obviously been in, you know, I've been deposed before. I had been in grand jury and things like that. So the testifying part isn't nerve-wracking. But obviously, when you're sitting there across from a defense attorney and they're asking you these questions, and the whole time I'm wondering, what is it that he's asking me that's helping his guy?
Yeah.
Because there was nothing.
I thought, I mean, look, I used that experience because it was something as a young prosecutor, like you always have to prepare your cases as if they're going to trial, because you have to take that seriously, that I need to be able to prove my case beyond a reasonable doubt. And there's a reason why the federal conviction rate is so high, because really, federal prosecutors in particular, we should only be bringing cases that you can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And defense attorneys should say, you know, let's try to work out a plea agreement here. But I think it was a good teaching tool, because I had always said to agents, like, always be ready to testify at trial. And I had always sort of naturally assumed it would be testifying for us. But then it was, well, look, you should be prepared to testify for either side. So it was a good teaching moment. And, you know, and I think it helped us, you know, get to the right result and obviously prepare our cases that much better, you know, in the future.
Yeah. So the end result wound up being we got there were 17 convictions, 15 that did not go to trial, 2 that went to trial. Even on the hung jury during the retrial, the jury was swift in their response. And then the other jury was out very quickly as well. There were some, the defense attorneys were difficult, to say the least. A lot of not so friendly conversations among them after hours and things like that. It was a challenge to deal with them as defense attorneys, you know, and it just sort of was a learning experience. I had never dealt with defense attorneys that were that full of anger for things for no reason. I just, it was, you know, I always say right is right and wrong is wrong. If your client really is in the, you know, even in the gray, and you're taking your case to the mat, or you feel like your client's in the right, and I do a lot of work on the defense side now, and I truly believe that in some instances, the U.S. Attorney's Office takes a sometimes aggressive approach to things. On some of the cases I'm working now, I don't understand where the U.S. Attorney's Office is going on matters, even when I have helped with instances where we have been able to debunk some of the loss amount calculations. They'll come back with, well, what about this and what about this? It's a very different landscape than when we were working. One of the things that I always appreciated working with you, as well as a few of the other criminal AUSAs in Newark, was the reasonableness that always existed. It wasn't this belief of we need to charge 20 things. If there's one thing that's chargeable, if there's a way to resolve this, let's resolve this. Let's make sure that it's resolved in the right way. I think that to an extent that's not really what I'm seeing. I'm seeing a very aggressive approach. Healthcare fraud's a terrible thing. It's a scourge on society in this country, but the level of zeal that I think is out there is sometimes a little bit much. And it makes me not feel so I've gone to the dark side so much as what's the equitable thing? What's the appropriate thing? And where is it? Where's a response measured that sort of, I think, has changed as time has gone on?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I think, you know, prosecutors' jobs were to do justice. And I think defense counsel in the trials, they zealously represented their client, and they're certainly entitled to do that. And I think at the end of the day, there wasn't hard feelings about it. But I do think that if prosecutors do their role and bring cases that they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and they make reasonable determinations about what they can and should bring, I mean, that was one of the things that we needed to decide, is what kind of charges were we going to bring. There was probably a bunch of different charges that we thought we could prove, but we wanted to say, like, okay, we need to streamline this case. We don't want the jury up there forever. We don't want there to be too many. So we basically charged each individual payment that our cooperator had made to them. And then there was a conspiracy count. So it was really three counts that we right. went to trial on. And, you know, just off the top of my head, there's probably three, four or five other counts.
Sure. I mean, there could have been, there's potentially a tax charge because they're getting cash, not counting that cash. I know that, you know, when we were doing this case, we did not think about charging the Travel Act, but the Travel Act obviously sued after with sort of the next round of large cases, which was the Biodiagnostic Labs case, the BLS case, where mm-hmm. Travel Act was charged, I think maybe for the first time, where that was sort of a novel approach. And if you read press releases now on kickback cases, you will see that other districts around the country have adopted what we were doing in Newark with charging the Travel Act. You see the Travel Act is used frequently to rope in the payment of kickbacks in the commercial world. Because right. the anti-kickback statute doesn't contemplate that, because it's Medicare, Medicaid, and Congress hasn't changed the law. So, you know, there's obviously that evolution of things, and now you've got what's known as ECRA, the Eliminating Kickbacks in Recovery Act, which essentially has broadened kickbacks to things like sober homes and testing labs and things of that sort. So, you know, it's an evolving thing. But I still think, like, you know, when you look at today's kickback cases, you know, one of the reasons I call this retro fraud, and I said this to you before we got on the recording, is it's the same circus, different clowns, is that the manner in which the kickbacks are paid may change, meaning that now it could be things like service agreements. It could be speaker arrangements where no work is done for in return for those speaker arrangements, where the provider is paid some large, ridiculous amount of money. And in return for that large, ridiculous amount of money, they do nothing. They just, you know, they make their prescription referrals.
Yeah.
You know, in the genetic testing space, we're seeing tons of that. In the compounding with telemedicine and telehealth, we're seeing that. So it really is just a way that things have morphed themselves from one type of fraud to another. Do I think that there are still schemes in which people are paying cash for a blood lab referral or an MRI or any ancillary service? Or of course, it's still happening. It's just maybe the manner in which they're doing it. Maybe people have gotten smarter about closed door discussions. But you know, again, the Orange MRI case started with a guy in a room getting cash and cooperating. And that was a closed door conversation. And I'll still say that in most kickback cases, someone's got to tell on themselves. And it's usually not the kickback payment that's gotten them in trouble. It's these collateral healthcare frauds that are, you know, that are committed.
So. For sure. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think there were a lot of good learnings from this case. You know, I think there was, you know, in the end, there was over $2.3 million in forfeiture ordered. There was every defendant that was not a cooperator ended up doing some jail time. The largest sentence was, I think, 46 months. It ended up being, I mean, it was a large effort, a lot of work really on you and the other agents that helped build the case and helped us get it to the point where we thought we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt those charges.
And if you recall, there was one particular provider, Dinesh Patel, who actually went back to the well for a second bite when he was excluded. If you remember, he was part owner with his wife and another person of an adult daycare in Edison, New Jersey. And just before he went to his 3-month prison term, he sold his shares of the practice of the adult daycare to his wife on paper. Didn't actually do anything with that. Went to jail for 3 months, got out, and within a week of getting out, had his name back on the bank account and was back working in the business. And as a result of that, the adult medical daycare had to pay $2.7 million for employing an excluded individual. So we did that as a CMP action, a civil action. So sometimes, you know, I like to say that in the healthcare world, most of the time, those deterrent factors, as you lawyers like to call them, those 3553 factors of specific and general deterrence are typically met in the healthcare fraud when you're a doctor or a healthcare provider and you've risked licensure and exclusion and all that. But sometimes need a little bit of an extra push. Dr. Patel needed that extra push. But in the end, look, there are 20 resolutions, on this. The business no longer existed. The 20 people that were prosecuted either criminally or through CMP action were dealt with appropriately. And those that cooperated got the just rewards of their cooperation. They still were prosecuted. It was a great case. I got to be, I think, better friends with you and that other guy, who was the prosecutor in that case as well. I learned a lot. I think you learned a lot as a prosecutor. Yep. It was a good case. So,
yep. It really was.
So listen, in the interest of time, I want to thank you for coming. I really hope that everybody learned a little bit from this podcast. I am going to have you on again because I do want to talk a little bit more about just from a former prosecutor's perspective, some of your thoughts on things like loss amount calculations, the guidelines. I have a lot of discussions with people on intended versus actual loss amounts with respect to healthcare fraud. So I do maybe want to have you on another time to talk about that. But, you know, this was great. Again, I'm thanking Joe Mack. I can't thank him enough for coming on and spending time to talk about this. Please tune in to other episodes we have of Retro Fraud. Again, I'm Eric Rubenstein. I'm the Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support with Advice Health. Please catch our podcast. You can also catch me on Coffee, Compliance, and Chuckleheads, where we talk a little bit more in depth about compliance issues, data analytics, and the perspective that the law enforcement community has on healthcare fraud. So thanks very much for tuning in.
Thanks, Eric.